anywhere? Was it Boulder or Ukraine? Was there something about the Taoiseach or the Prime Minister of Spain? Sorry, I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. Hearing protesters who say, bring them home, as they're wrapped in blue and white. What differentiates them, I don't know, from the Holocaust deniers of the right. Perhaps an argument could be made in a time of peace, but this is total war. If you're talking about anything else, then what the hell do you stand for? Sorry, I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. I'm watching every morning as they wait in line instead of dying of starvation, forced to risk their lives for a bag of flour, what remains of the Palestinian nation.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, over the weekend, the University of Victoria hosted the first Vancouver Island Anti-Fascist Youth and Student Congress. The Congress was convened, they say, because of the urgent need of response to the threats at home and abroad to peace, human rights, and the environment. Tyson Strandlin is secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement, and he served as media liaison for the event that offered a, quote, array of community leaders and experts discussing various expressions and aspects of fascism, ranging from militarism and war, Zionism, colonialism, and neo-colonialism. Welcome back to the program, Tyson.
Hi, Chris. Thanks. Always good to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Before we get to the weekend's activities here in Victoria, you're just back from Africa. I'm really fascinated to find out, where did you go? Why did you go there? And what did you see?
So I was in Harare, Zimbabwe. I was invited by the Africa Youth Congress to attend an international youth summit on land and economic freedom. So I was just there for a fairly short time. The event was quite packed full of different speakers and discussions on the subject. There was a number of ministers and leaders of the leading ZANU-PF party. There were ambassadors giving greetings from the Chinese ambassador and the Nicaraguan ambassador, for example, and youth leaders from African countries across the continent. Discussing this ongoing issue with, the assertions of sovereignty and not just, political independence for African countries that was largely achieved during the decolonial waves in the 20th century, but now pushing forward to complete that for in terms of economic independence, because, of course, many of these countries are still, struggling against neocolonialism. The former colonial empires, the British and the French, and of course now the United States as well, as they have their own big economic interests in Africa, and they're punishing any African countries that try and assert that sovereignty. And in the case of Zimbabwe, it's a country that's been faced with sanctions by even the Canadian government. So that was certainly something we discussed as well.
Well, it seems to me from my distant armchair here in Canada that Africa is the center of revolutionary thought and action today, especially when we look at what's going on in the Sahel, along the Sahel Belt. Ibrahim Traore, of course, being the front guy from that, who looks all the world to me like an African Hugo Chavez. Did you pick up on that kind of energy there? Is this something way over in Zimbabwe that is resonating?
Yeah, there's no question. It was really quite inspiring being there, that there's an immense sense of hopefulness, and there's a great deal of joy in the youth struggle, and a sense of unity, of pan-Africanism. The people who are being held up as sort of ideological leaders are people like Thomas Sankara, people like Kwame Nkrumah, all these, you know, great Pan-Africanist thinkers of the 20th century. And as for, you know, Venezuela was also invited to send delegates to the Congress, but they were unable to because they were going through elections at the time. But nevertheless, the chair of the Africa Youth Congress, Comrade Kandashaya, is a good friend of mine. And we actually met in Venezuela last year at the International Anti-Fascist Youth and Student Congress that was held in Caracas, which, again, ties these two things together quite neatly.
Well, and tying it together even further, I saw Telus Sewer managed to do an interview with you about the goings-on over the weekend, as I mentioned in the introduction, up at UVic. Do you want to talk about what was going on this side of the world and why that would be of interest to people down in Venezuela?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, we discussed several months ago after I'd come back from that on your show a little bit about that Congress that took place there. And I think it was a really important event in that it was bringing together youth and students from around the world to fight in a sort of very internationalist way what is this international problem of global, you know, the rise of fascism, the rise of the far right. And I think that the framework that was established there, that, you know, of approaching it in terms of different expressions, as it appears in different places around the world, whether we're talking about in Africa, the struggle against neocolonialism, whether we're talking about, you know, Zionism in the Middle East, or whether we're talking about militarism and war and the drive to increase military spending, you know, with NATO and stuff here. This is something that needs this kind of global solidarity because, you know, that's our strength. Of course, fascism and imperialism, they've got a lot of money on their side. They've got a lot of power on their side. But at the end of the day, it's something that serves the interests of a very elite few. So recognizing the our common interests and solidarity with one another, that's what's really important about all these events here. And that's what we're trying to build at the University of Victoria and in Canada more generally amongst the youth.
Well, important too is media, and you got some coverage from distant Venezuela, but how about the local media? Did anybody pick you up?
Just you, Chris. You know, we sent up press releases
again.
Yeah, it's to your credit, really. I mean, you know, I think this is something that needs a lot more attention, but we could spend all day talking about why they're not going to report on these sorts of events at the Czech or CBC or the other ones.
Well, maybe we could educate a little then on this platform about fascism. It's one of those terms that's been beaten to death over the years, purposefully in some cases to obscure its actual meaning. Can you give us a primer, or for those that are confused saying, well, I don't know, it's always fascism this, fascism that, of the telltale signs of the genuine article and why this is an issue that impels you and your comrades to resist?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, about the I think deliberate attempts to obscure the real nature of what fascism is. And I think that's something we need to take really seriously, because identifying it before it's too late is a really important part of it, which is something we're trying to do in terms of educating people. Because, you know, it's something that I think the most important thing we need to remember is it's an instrument of class power. We're talking about a class war here. We're talking about the interests of the absolute rich and using the strength of the state to basically rule in an increasingly open terroristic dictatorship. Fascism has a couple aspects to it, right? It has this aspect of coercion and violence, but it also utilizes deceit, right? I mean, fascism has to have a broad sort of mass base of support outside the sort of small interests that it represents. Otherwise, it couldn't function, right? But it has to lie about those interests, because you couldn't get regular working people to support it if they knew what it really was. And that's one of the differences between fascism and the former, you know, old style of militaristic or monarchic dictatorships that predated it back in, you know, like the 19th century and everything. So, you know, fascism can only take root in a society where you've got uncertainty, where you've got poverty, where you've got people who are homeless and jobless and who need somebody to blame for that, right? It feeds on a very, in fact, justified sense of injustice, a sense of something not right in society. But it scapegoats groups. It scapegoats anybody but the ruling class, right? It can point the finger at women's rights, at the labor movement, at environmentalists, at the 2S LGBTQ plus movement, as long as it's anything but the ruling class. And I think, you know, increasingly in Canada, we've seen this sort of populist right-wing rhetoric, right? People angry with immigrants and, racist movements on the rise and angry with Indigenous people. And these are people who really are acting against their own interests in supporting this. They don't realize that their anti-elite sort of attitude is being sort of misguided.
Well, and almost a century after Hitler's and Mussolini's rise in Europe, the Make America Great slogan is ringing yet across America. But this, too, was the kind of ideology that Hitler used in Germany. You know, he appealed to some ancient sense of greatness and exceptionalism and stirred the hearts of the German people who were in miserable conditions after the defeat of the First World War. And in Italy, Mussolini hearkened back to the glory days of Rome, saying, "Oh no, you're better than this, and you know we can go out and be dominating again." This seems to be an echoing feature of this ideology.
Absolutely, but you know it's always a mythologized version of history. You know, they put aside many of the other real aspects of this and make people believe that it was something that it wasn't, and it makes them believe that they have something to gain by this fascist policy, which they'll wrap in a national flag, but really is never in the so-called national interest. It's in the interest of the ruling classes only, of the capitalists and the industrialists in Nazi Germany, where they were the ones who had to benefit. Who was the one who paid the cost? It was working people, and it was the labor movement that got attacked. It was the other political parties that were banned, and of course it was the sons of the working class people who were the first to go and die, sent in wars. The Thousand-Year Reich demonstrated that it was not so long-lasting as it was supposed to be, and that's because fascism brings to the fore these sort of contradictions that are inherent in this really unstable, I think, economic model, which is capitalism, right? And that's what we're seeing in the United States. Fascism is not something that they jump to out of preference. It's something that they go to on the back foot. So I think people need to have also optimism about this, right? Fascism isn't a sign of strength. It's a sign of weakness that comes with its own risks and just shows how on stilts the entire thing is. So I think that's another really encouraging thing that we need to be discussing as youth and progressives and activists about how we're going to resist and fight back.
Yeah, well, the working class in America is certainly suffering today, just as in Italy and Germany. It was Italians and Germans that were the first victims of fascism there. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Tyson Real Strandland. He is secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement. We're talking in and around the recent anti-fascist youth congress held up at UVic over the weekend. Well, Tyson, Canada is a nice country, though. Canada is prosperous right now, at least relatively so. And yet there are eerie parallels going on in this country that are worrisome. Is this just me? Am I being paranoid? Or are you seeing the fascist head arising even here in prosperous little Canada?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right, Chris. And, I did my master's thesis was largely focused on fascism and imperialism and these sorts of trends. So as a historian, I'm particularly sensitive to the parallels that we're seeing here. And I think that, why we're seeing those parallels is again, it's rooted in the sort of the inherent instability and contradictions of capitalism, right? Because only in a society where you have this instability, where you have economic insecurity, where people are looking for where they're going to be able to live, how they're going to be able to pay their rent, how they can, get a job that pays enough for them to support their family, support their kids. This is the sort of society where fascism takes root. When everybody has what they need, it's a lot harder to convince people to hate and fear other groups of people, to convince them that, it's China or Iran or Russia is a danger to our democracy, to our sovereignty, or to that indigenous peoples who are all these myths they have that they don't pay taxes, that they get to go to university for free, and that's somehow what's keeping other working people from achieving what they should be achieving, right? And not making as much money and making ends meet the way they used to be. So we're going to see this economic situation get worse. And people are going to get more desperate. And if there's not a strong progressive analysis, a left-wing united analysis about the realities of this, it's the far right who are going to pick up the slack and who are going to be there to say that, no, the problem is this group of people and that group of people. And they're going to do everything they can to keep dividing us in this country. And it's something we need to take very seriously.
Well, and concretely, we're seeing the drive towards militarism. The Globe and Mail, the so-called self-referred national newspaper of Canada, putting out, as I was just discussing with Eve Engler, op-eds saying that, well, in order to meet our obligations to NATO, according to this writer, that it may become and will become presumably necessary for Canada to trim the old age pension program, equalization payments to the provinces, this writer says, and also pharmacare and healthcare and that dental thing that was such a cornerstone of the former prime minister's legacy, that to put the costs directly on the people in the country that need those kinds of services most.
Yeah, because that's the root of it, right? This crisis where they need to find more sources of money, because I mean we've got people who can't afford to buy back the sort of products of that they're producing and the services that they're producing, right? And this is where you see this drive to war, and they're all these methods that they go to try and extend the lifespan of this very unstable system, whether it's extending more credit, taking more debt, the United States, for example, trillions of dollars in debt, or whether it's redirecting public funds back into private hands. The attacks on our healthcare system, sure, the push to privatize, but also on other public services like Canada Post, increasingly there's been talks about making it a sort of crown corporation or a private corporation that receives public subsidies and public funds, but always these deliver less, and they're just trying to draw this out more. And people are being convinced of this this belief that they have something to benefit from, these sorts of policies, the policies of war, just like the people in Nazi Germany were convinced into believing that they had something to gain when they were the first to lose, or the people in South Africa, whites in South Africa, who came to believe that their standard of living depended on apartheid, which was anything but true. So, this is why it's so important for us to really put out this message of unity, broad unity across the country, across the youth and the working class, but also unity across borders as well. I mean, right now, the whole tariff thing between Canada and the United States and talks about making Canada the 51st state. I think it's a mistake to view this in terms of something between the people of Canada and the United States. This is a class war. It's a class war of the corporations on both sides who are happy to have increased integration in order to exploit working people on both sides of the border.
Well, and every single politician in our recent election, our recent federal election here in Canada, they emphasized nationalism. They distanced themselves from Donald Trump and the Americans because of the trade war that that new president has launched almost immediately in office. Carney did the best job of that, presumably, because he ended up as prime minister. And any astute follower of politics realizes Canadians don't want, for the main part, don't want to become the 51st state or some other kind of appendage of the American system. And yet, immediately on gaining office, just a few days ago, Carney says that he's willing to go along with the biggest militarization project ever, this Golden Dome, so-called, that Donald Trump is trying to sell to Americans, that's going to cost billions upon billions, untold. And Trump is using that even as a lever, even as he uses it as a lever for annexing Canada, Carney is still going along with it. It seems that everything he said during the election campaign is evaporating.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing that we all have to remember. Where is the billions of dollars coming from for increased militarism, for the massive amounts we spend on NATO and on NORAD and the Canadian military? Well, it comes from cuts to public services, right? And when we have those cuts, and it increases the arguments when people are waiting, you know, 12 hours in the hospital waiting room and saying that, okay, our healthcare system is inefficient or this or that, it increases the justification towards privatization. And who is it who benefits from privatization first and foremost? It's corporations, and in fact, predominantly U.S. corporations. It's going to be U.S. Healthcare. I was going to say providers, but healthcare. Like hostage takers, really. These corporations that are going to benefit from the privatization, even piecemeal. You know, increasingly we're seeing these P3s and stuff, private public partnerships. At the expense of working people. And what's taking place in that way is very serious.
Well, even today, 75% of the Canadian money that is spent on defense is spent in the United States, in American companies. That's not enough, though, it seems, for the current administration. And the NATO mavens want to increase from... they say that GDP of NATO members should be spending on defense, and I'm using their terminology on militarism, should rise 3.5% in the first instance, and then an extra 1.5% over time of each country's GDP. It's a crazy movement in that direction. The next thing, though, like just hot off the press, this I think I saw just yesterday that, when Hitler took over, one of the first things he took over in Germany was the border and using the border agents and stuff as his beginning of his stormtroopers. The Strong Borders Act was announced just a couple of days ago, Bill C-2. Have you followed this?
It's been a busy couple of days for me. I didn't hear the exact details, but...
So I'm leading again. So putting this out for everybody to cock an ear to Bill C-2. It's very similar to what we saw in the United States, actually. And it's the government is being criticized for using this legislation as a salve to the Americans because they were complaining and part of the trade tariffs were based on the border and people and products they allege coming into the United States from Canada were causing a problem for them. And so, but it seems to go even further than that. And immigrant groups and refugee groups are already raising the alarm that this Bill C-2 is a bit of a Trojan horse.
You're right, actually. I now that I'm awake now, for real, I do remember hearing about this just yesterday. I think that the thing about this as well is it has a very real effect on the way that people, perceive the issues in this country. Because once again, it's scapegoating some of the most exploited and oppressed groups of people. And, whether you're somebody who voted Liberal or you voted NDP or whatever, I think that this is increasing this sort of rhetoric that this is the problem. And I think that it's no coincidence that the main groups to benefit from that are often on the far right, who are going to be harder on immigrants, who are going to be harder on racialized people, right? Because it's, again, it implies that's the problem.
This went to first reading only yesterday, so this is all really hot off the press stuff. Did you follow the elections? Was that something promised?
I did follow the elections, of course, but I found a lot of what Mark Carney was saying. I don't remember any specific discussion on that. I remember a lot of what he was saying. He seemed to tread fairly carefully. I think he was smart to, as opposed to Pierre Poilievre, who, I think got rightfully, aligned in people's minds as being too pro-American, too Trump. I think that Carney was just a little more careful about that. And, of course, there can be no mistaking, though, he's very clearly a representative of big business and, the corporate interests in Canada. I think that the goal here is just to try and refine it and put, a kind of different spin on it. But no big promises in terms of, improvements and policies in people's lives. And when we talk about, Canada becoming an appendage of the United States, I think that the important thing to recognize here is that Canada already is an appendage of the United States. Mm. And this rhetoric about making Canada the 51st state, I think it largely is kind of rhetoric with certain goals. I think that they don't need to make Canada the 51st state because we're already completely integrated militarily. We're deeply integrated economically and politically. And, you know, again, the United States is the only country that ever actually threatened Canada's sovereignty. But it's nevertheless, Canada's still here making these sorts of policies at the behest of Washington. You know, during the trade war, more sanctions on Venezuela, which Venezuela responded scathingly to. It's actually a great response, you know, increased tariffs on China. And these sorts of policies about the border. But is it doing us any favors? Is it winning us any special privilege from the United States? No, certainly not.
Well, as Dimitri Lascaris refers to Mark Carney as Prime Minister Goldman Sachs, so I don't think that we should really expect anything different from him. But it is our desperation for good news. At least I can speak for myself, and I can see other people. I have one friend who expressed surprise at the volte-face of our current Prime Minister, at least the speed of it. Anyway, I was not so surprised as that. We're fast running out of time here, Tyson. Do you want to tell us how people can find out more, like what you guys, as if you've got more events coming up, and give us a reminder of who the Popular Democracy Movement is and how people can find out what it's about?
Right. So the Popular Democracy Movement was an organization that myself and some others started actually just about a year ago. It'll be a year on, I think, June 8th. And since then, it's been very actively involved in terms of trying to increase the level of understanding and education about these issues in a way that allows us to actually sort of start to fight back, you know, because the progressives in this country have been on the back foot and we've been taking losses and fighting a rearguard battle. We need something that's going to actually meet the demands of today with a modern analysis of what is to be done. And so it's a broad anti-fascist movement. It's a movement for real progress and change in people's lives. Because if youth don't have a progressive alternative to look to, we're going to keep losing. And again, people who see their only choice is voting liberal to stop the far right, it's only, you know, we're just in the waiting room of history. Unless we really get organized in the labor movement and in the universities. And in building a broad people's movement that can fight back, well, we're just waiting until the next election, and it's going to be even worse for us. But fascism doesn't just come with one election. It's a whole broad process that takes place over time, and that's something we need to get across. But the Popular Democracy Movement has a website. We're available on Instagram. And the Anti-Fascist Youth and Student Coordinating Committee, which we were part of, is going to be doing another Congress probably next year. This one was so successful, we're thinking we want to do it annually, sort of as part of the broad international anti-fascist movement started in Caracas, Venezuela.
Well, and the great optimism, at least in my mind right now, and I urge everyone to pay attention to what's going on in Africa, especially if what you see going on in Gaza and West Asia is so soul-crushing, that there is movement, there is a huge swell of liberation in Africa that is growing even day by day. More countries are coming towards this. They're kicking out foreigners. They're saying no to raw exports, something that this country should maybe look at too. And taking over, they're taking the reins of their own destiny, something that must happen.
Absolutely.
Tyson, it's great to speak to you again. Good luck, and keep us apprised of future movements, eh?
Thanks a lot, Chris. You bet.
And I also want to thank Eve Engler. That's all I got for this week. Until the next time. Thanks again, Tyson.
As they're wrapped in blue and white, what differentiates them, I don't know, from the Holocaust deniers of the right. Perhaps an argument could be made in a time of peace, but this is total war. If you're talking about anything else, then what the hell do you stand for? Sorry I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. Watching every morning as they wait in line instead. instead of dying of starvation. Forced to risk their lives for a bag of flour, what remains of the Palestinian nation?